The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly. Dust off your Six and the City headlines as Man City trash Tottenham. While it's never mind the Borats at the Emirates as Saints goalie caught with pants down in spot of pole dancing. Man United slip at Cardiff and managerless Crystal Palace, their 10-man win at Hull explained. The fewer Palace players that are on the pitch, the better it is for them. Also today, Champions League. Borussia, beaten by Bayern, now face a crunch game with Napoli. And after a weekend that saw angry ultras lay siege to San Siro, Milan face another tough crowd in Glasgow. We look forward to the whole kit and caboodle. Round up your posts and tweets and more in today's Football Weekly. Right, off we go then on another Football Weekly. Greg Bukowski joining us today. Hi, Greg.
Hi, James.
In your buttoned-up denim, looking good.
Yeah.
Right. We'll be talking about that derby.
Yeah. Ooh,
what a derby. Hey, Raphael's here as well.
Hello, James.
Nice to see you, Rafa. And also Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Old school. Nice, because you know, I just used the word kit and caboodle, and you're in a position to tell us what that actually means, because I was curious. Well, where does caboodle come from?
It just means that, you know, the whole sort of whole gathering of people, the whole meeting. And I think it comes from, I think it's from the States in the sort of, you know, the 1800s.
A caboodle refers to a gathering of people, does
it? Yeah.
Rafa, you speak English. You got any ins on this? Any lines on the etymology? I asked because the other day we were talking about swashbuckling. We were able to establish what that actually means.
My wife once worked on balderdash and piffle, which obviously looked at where the origins of words, and she worked on the C word.
Oh.
So she found out all about that.
All right, is that...
she involved...
I don't know, the F word's an acronym, isn't it?
I wouldn't know.
It's the sum of the initial for unlawful carnal knowledge, I believe. I believe that's where the F word comes from. Now, anyway, what were we saying? Oh, yeah, terrific weekend of football. Terrific weekend of football. There was that derby. We'll talk about that in a bit. But, of course, Man City kind of trumped everybody with their extraordinary 6-0 doing over of Tottenham Hotspur. Our game plan lasted 14 seconds, says Andre Villas-Boas.
It did. I mean, boxers talk about, you know, when they're punched early, being caught cold, and Spurs just... weren't there at all from the moment that, you know, Lloris made that mistake. When you look at City play like that, I mean, they've scored now 26 goals in their 6 home games, which is equal best with Sunderland in 1935-36. They have a 22 goal difference, which is the best in the league by some way. There's no way that team should be 6 points behind Arsenal. And they are, when they play well, clearly the best side in the league. I mean, they were sensational.
When they play at home, they're clearly the best side.
Absolutely.
The amazing thing, though, was that they didn't have that much control over sections of the game. I thought Spurs had a lot of possession.
They had more possession than City.
Yeah. They got into the final third time and time again. They just couldn't get that ball right, ever. And I didn't feel as if Toure and Fernandinho were really controlling the game as such. But every time they did manage to get forward and get Aguero involved, when he was running at the Spurs defenders, there was just absolutely no chance for them.
You get false statistics, though. I think when there's a goal so early in a game, then that sets the kind of, you know, the rhythm of the match, and you know the team that's in front can often just, you know, drop a little bit deeper, and perhaps City understood to it, actually, you know, and felt comfortable against a Spurs team who's struggling to score goals.
This is incredibly dull, but last season,
that's not a nice thing to say.
Every team, when they were ahead, had less possession in the Premier League,
really?
Than when the score was level. So that's that backs Greg's point up.
Every single team.
Oh, they had. So if a team had say 60% of possession, and then went 1-0 up,
They would then have less possession.
Because it makes sense. Because you basically
two questions then about Andre Villas-Boas. One, it can happen to any manager to have your plans disrupted by conceding a goal early, especially against Man City. But how well did he revisit his tactics and try and get back into the game?
Well, I think the answer's in the 6-0 scoreline.
Really?
I
mean, even though they consistently had possession and chances?
But it's been their problem all season, this lack of, you know, incision. People talk about Soldado. I mean, when he played for Valencia last year, he scored a lot of goals, but a lot of those goals were from close range. He was sort of a fox in the box.
Yeah, they were doing off crosses as well, off and not inside out wingers who kind of look to come inside and join in the play with the striker. So that's how he benefits, and Villas-Boas hasn't got the team set up that way.
It's like someone with gastroenteritis spurs at the moment. You knew there was problems at one end, and now there's also problems at the other, which is, you know, is not a good sign.
Sean's a man who knows quite a lot about illnesses, right? And probably had gastroenteritis.
What you're saying, the days of clean sheets are over for Spurs, eh? Going forward then, the next question about Andre Villas-Boas is, how well do you see him picking his team up from this one, given that their next opponent is Man United?
It's not necessarily a bad opponent. It's a big game. United aren't flying at the moment. They're at home.
But do you see that the team could be massively demoralised after conceding six like this? I mean, it's humiliating to see, right?
Clearly it was, but I mean, God, they'll pick themselves up. It's United come along,
I've been fairly positive about Spurs and his reign so far, but what troubled me yesterday watching this was that good teams rotate because they want to change players but not necessarily change the system, so they don't lose a lot of the fluidity. Spurs have zero fluidity in the final third. Everything seems to be completely accidental, and because the formation and because the personnel changes and different wingers, as you said, Greg, do different things, one doesn't seem to be knowing what the other guy's doing at any time. That's why so many balls break down. There's just, they never get through into the box, and it's very strange. I mean, you'd expect that's where really a manager has to do some work. You'll have to you can't just rely on your clearly talented players to come up with their own ideas. Maybe you just actually need to do a bit more in training.
Last season they were set up perfectly to make the most out of Bale and Lennon's pace, and they squashed the game into the centre of the pitch so they could just spring behind the defence with pace, and perhaps they're still set up like that now, but they haven't got Gareth Bale there. I mean, Lennon's just coming back from injury, so maybe he will help, but Andros Townsend would have seemed, he seems necessary to their formation now with his pace.
Meanwhile, the way Dawson and Cabal were exposed, it seems remarkable that they kept the defensive record they have.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, Dawson has been, he's been slow, and as I've said in previous podcasts, he's been creaky for quite some time now. Cabal had just come back from injury, and they're Aguero with his pace and the way Negredo plays, they're a lovely partnership, the two of them, the way that Negredo holds the ball up and can flick the ball off for Aguero to come behind. They were horribly exposed against City.
Were you calling them the best team potentially in the Premier League?
I think if any team is going to do what United did last season and several other teams have done in the last few years, which is go on a run around this time and run away in the league, it should be City. I mean, I think you've got to look at their, they've beaten United 4-1, they've beaten Everton 3-1, they've beaten Newcastle 4-0, they've beaten Spurs now 6-0. That's four sides in the top nine they've thrashed. I think when you look at their rivals, which we'll probably come on to, they all have their flaws, as have City. But if anyone, when you have company coming back, if they have a goalkeeper that doesn't make mistakes, they should be the side you would expect. I think they're the favourites for the league.
They're back in the top four, but as you say, 6 points behind Arsenal, who themselves got a victory in the eagerly anticipated battle of first v third, which was notable mainly for that extraordinary piece of goalkeeping, which everyone's had a bit of a pop at him over, from Artur Boric. Pochettino saying, "I do ask my goalies to play out from the back." And it is, one of the risks of this new style of goal mind, of net minding. But obviously hideous stuff. Without that, do you think Southampton would have made a proper game of this?
Don't see why not. They played well this season. I don't think Arsenal were brilliant, but I think it says a lot for how they are playing and the confidence in the team. This was a good old-fashioned routine 2-0 win without playing well, which perhaps Arsenal haven't had enough of in the last two, three, four years. So, most Southampton have played the season. I wouldn't have shocked me if they'd have gone to the Emirates and got a point. I mean, they went to Liverpool and won, so sure.
Right. Okay. I mean, we could have a go at Boric, but everybody has by now. So, yeah. Arsenal next up have Marseille in the Champions League. It is a very tight group, that. They are level with Napoli on top of the group, both on 9 points. And Borussia Dortmund, we'll talk more about them and their clash with Napoli a little bit later on. Arsenal are taking on Marseille, who are bottom of the group. But did have a 3-1 win against Ajaccio. Terrific goal, wasn't it, Rafa, from André-Pierre Gignac?
Rather special.
Yeah. And they don't have anything to play for, which is often the most dangerous thing in a team.
Or not.
Yeah, or not. We'll see about that one. Hey, Man United also on Sunday, like their neighbours City, went down to Cardiff. A 2-2 draw. Duncan Player says, do the Rooneys and Gerrards, etc., really get treated differently by referees? What's your take, Craig?
I don't understand what's he on about with Gerrard because of the elbow thing.
Probably the elbow there, but let's focus on the Rooney.
Yeah, I think Rooney was lucky. He took a swipe against Much, and he should have been sent off. But the referee did see it, and it's a strange one that he didn't send him off. Perhaps he didn't think it was. He thought it was more of a tangling of legs. So, I mean, you can only go on what the referee's interpretation is, I suppose. And he maybe saw it as a tangling of legs or something instead of a petulant swipe out, which is what it was, and should have been a red card.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, talking about the Gerrard one there, that was slightly different because there was no contact, and maybe that is what coloured the opinion.
Yeah, very possibly.
I mean, I don't think it's so much players. I think it's big clubs, referees, even if it's just at the back of the mind, know that if I do something here, I'll hear about this all week, and the manager's going to slaughter me, and he's going to say I destroyed football because I sent somebody off early. I think these things, you'll never be able to quantify them, and very few referees will probably go on the record saying, yes, it does play on my mind, but I think you probably have to assume that it does play a role.
But it feeds into the whole, and there's been a lot of academic research on home team bias, right, and also big club bias.
But this was an away team.
No, but and big club bias as well. It happens.
See, I'm not sure if I do agree that there is a kind of an unconscious bias towards the big club or a particularly difficult home crowd. But I think there are certain players who do enjoy almost a charmed life, and Rooney's certainly one of them. And when you talk about big clubs getting the favours, Liverpool are a big club, but Suarez certainly doesn't get the favours. I mean, he's always the example that's brought in, but if Suarez was to do what Rooney did, then he would...
But when Suarez bit someone, that
was obviously a fairly extreme example.
But that wasn't spotted. That relied on video evidence before people...
Yeah, I agree. That wasn't spotted.
The whole Negrito thing that came out later, that wasn't spotted.
But
Rooney
just seems to have an astonishing collection of quite violent action, which is very, very rarely sanctioned properly. Unless he's playing outside the Premier League in, say, a qualifying match, in which case, bingo, the referee spots it and does something about it.
Do you think a referee, in the amount of time they have to, calculate what's just happened and go over it, they see the incident and they probably make up their mind what they're going to do about it, and then they see that it's that player. You're saying after they see which player it is, they maybe take the time, and when there's a bit of a melee,
I think the brain is capable of seeing who the player is while watching the action. I think your interpretation of the action depends perhaps on who's actually doing it. I mean, most of us base our judgment of actions a lot on who's actually doing them.
I honestly believe that a predisposition of a Premier League referee is always not to send the guy off, regardless for who it is. And I think in that they differ from the European ones. Right. So it's not so much that Rooney's getting an easy ride here and a difficult ride elsewhere. It's that they're much more prepared to punish people for their misdemeanours, whereas here this is viewed at,
Right. I'm sure Wes Brown's going to
give him. You can give him a good lecture. Yeah, and obviously,
was it the fact then that it was just 7 or 8 minutes into the game? That's why the referee didn't want to. Fair result anyway. The 2-2
probably just about was. I mean, United probably should have finished it before they did.
I thought they really missed Carrick in midfield to control the game when they were leading, and cleverly. And Fellaini can't do what Carrick does in terms of keeping possession and keeping things, recycling the ball and making sure that Cardiff didn't get back into the game. I think they really lacked. They really suffered because Carrick wasn't playing.
I mean, the most amazing thing coming out of this game for me is the David Moyes comment afterwards, who said he would have taken the draw before the game, which I thought was an amazing thing to say for Man United manager, who plays at a newly promoted team. Yes, they had international week, but so did a lot of teams, including Manchester City, of course, who didn't seem to suffer too much from it. So
Evra completely contradicted him after the game, saying we're Man United, we should come to these places and get 3 points. So he's one of the senior players there, and he's got a difference of opinion with his manager.
Well, it leaves him 7 points behind Arsenal at the top of the table in sixth place. Next up, Bayer Leverkusen. This, no formality for them in the Champions League, Rafa?
No, it will be difficult. Leverkusen have a very fixed way of playing, which is to sit fairly deep and then hit them on the break. United, away from home, are quite happy to cede concession as well. So I wonder if it's going to be like one of those badminton games at the Olympics, where both sides try to serve straight into the net. Do you remember that scandal? United have that bit of extra know-how, that bit more quality that can see them through, as it did in the first meeting at Old Trafford, where Leverkusen were just a little bit naive at the back and didn't take their chances. But there's no reason why they shouldn't at least get a draw at home. They will miss Sidney Sam. He's been in great form for them. He picked up an injury against Hertha on Saturday. But still, you know, they've got a very decent side there.
Second in the Bundesliga, unbeaten in 13 at home. And if they win, then Man United's qualification...
No one is guaranteed qualification in that group yet.
There you go.
Speaking of Sam, I know he plays on one side of attacking force, and you've got the South Korean Heung-Min Son on the other. There's no centre-forward called Of, or, you know, in Germany, is there? Because then you could have an attacking lineup of Son of Sam, which would be quite good.
That would be amazing.
I think I've seen that band live. They're pretty good, you know.
Now, Saturday's derby then, Greg.
Yes.
Typically cagey affair.
Yeah, you know, it was typical 0-0, wasn't it? It was a game that was could have been 7-all by the end. It was just two teams going at it, brilliant frenetic, gungo, like two fellas like walloping each other in the car park. There's, you know, hardly any defence at all. And it's probably one of the best derbies I've seen, going back to the 4-4 in 91.
Right.
I was, you know, 11 or whatever it was at the time. I don't remember that so well. There's been a lot of great derbies since then, but this one particularly was just... It was just non-stop. I mean, like, from the first goal that Liverpool scored, Everton came back, and there was hardly any control in the midfield area from Liverpool, particularly. I thought Everton controlled the midfield much better, and largely because Gerrard, as a kind of defensive midfielder, decided to kind of play on the right wing, and he delivers great balls in from the right-hand side, but he doesn't help the team out in any way, you know, in a game where a team is going to be attacking, to actually kind of, you know, manage what's going on in midfield. You'll have seen the goal. Suarez's free kick was unbelievably accurate, because there was a tiny gap between Pienaar and the rest of the wall, and he just exploited it brilliantly. The fact that he hit it low, you know, was deliberate as well, and it couldn't have been in any better place. He's, you know, fantastic player.
I think that might be my favourite free kick ever, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh. Really?
I love that free kick.
The other one I really, really loved was in a derby as well, which was Gary McAllister's from all of like 40 yards out, which was another one lower. That beat Suarez's for me.
Really?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Oh, let's go look at that one up.
Tough call, but I think Metgod's an old favourite. Johnny Metgod.
Oh, right, okay.
Forest against West Ham. I think Zico, or was it Ed Ayer in the 82 World Cup as well? Curling it over Alan Roth.
Yeah, they're all night. This was just remarkable. The pace and the precision of it.
Roberto
and
Carlos?
The curve as well. No, this was better than the Carlos for me, because the Carlos was... They didn't have the finesse of this one here. Yeah, a huge amount of
Suarez. Suarez knew exactly where he needed to put it, and put it in that area from, you know.
I think also I'm just a bit bored of seeing those, you know, classic Ronaldos or the dead leaf or any of those. This was, right, maybe not the best ever, but it's an absolutely astonishing goal.
Yeah. And Kevin Morales' retribution job on Suarez in the derby for what Suarez did last year, which was...
Oh, right, okay, so that was retribution for what?
Oh, I'm pretty sure it was, yeah. Suarez went down his Achilles last season.
Right.
Morales was out for about 5 or 6 weeks after that, and suffered, I think, you know, for 3 or 4 months with injuries coming back into the Everton team. And there was no way he was going for the ball in that tackle. You look at him, and the ball's like 2 yards away. And he just goes and completely nobbles Suarez. Should have been sent off, as Suarez should have been last year. But that's no excuse for him not going. And then there was another ropey incident later on in the game when he kind of came down on Suarez. Could have moved his boot out of the way, but made sure it went down his back. And he's, you know, very good player though, Kevin Morales, as he showed. He's got a nasty side to him there as well.
Bayer don't have the Son of Sam, but Liverpool are playing with Flanagan and Allen at in this game, and which brings us on nicely to Joe Allen. And what if you're not happy with my greatest free kick ever? That's a pretty special miss that Joe came up with.
It was a spectacular miss, and I feel quite sorry for Joe Allen, because he got dogs abuse after the match from Liverpool fans, and I thought he had, you know, as kind of absent as Liverpool's midfield was at times, I actually thought he had a decent game, considering he was coming back in for his first start in a long, long time, and there was players who played much worse than him. He kept possession reasonably well through the game, and he was playing in a more advanced position, but I'm not going to make any excuses for that miss. You could have scored that, Jimbo. I reckon.
I'm not sure, Rafa. You saw me.
I reckon you'd have given
Sunday night. Scored that? I think I had a bigger miss than that in front of an open goal on Sunday night. I think I did. Well, listen, just to finish off part one, then completely changing tack, let's return to Southampton because I just noticed a little post here from Dante Meets Bosch, who says, I'm enjoying seeing Southampton doing so well, but he's wondering if they're going to be this year's version of the surprise team that starts the season well but then fades, a la West Brom last time, or Bolton in 2010-11, or Hull, or Man City in 7-8.
But West Brom, this last season, were, I think, fourth or maybe fifth. They finished eighth, I think.
Right.
That's where you'd expect them to come. I think Southampton will probably finish seventh or eighth. They will regress a little bit.
So they will do.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but they were fourth or the fifth. Yeah. That's inevitable.
They lost by the same scoreline Liverpool lost at the Emirates.
Yeah, I mean, but even
though... And arguably were more competitive.
But if they finish eighth or ninth, I don't think they'll finish much below that, because Swansea is a gap between Swansea and Spurs between ninth and tenth. That would be a fantastic achievement.
There's not really a surprise element about Southampton either. I think, like, they are just... You know, most people know how they're going to play. They're good defensively. They play some nice football going forwards, and it's not like there's, you know, people are trying to suss them out. I think they do what they do very well and make it difficult for teams against them. So I think they'll finish, you know, maybe seventh, maybe eighth position, which is very creditable. But also they spent a lot of money on three, you know, very good players to strengthen their club. And
are you calling Osvaldo a good player?
Well, yeah. It's interesting because the good players haven't really been behind their success so far, with the exception of at the back, Lovren, who wasn't even playing in this game. But
which could be seen as a very encouraging thing.
Certainly.
They start playing as well.
That's it for part one. Coming up in part two, excitingly, Rafa's trip to the Signale Iduna Park.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Right, the Signale Iduna Park, a.k.a. the Westfalen Stadium, also known as home of Borussia Dortmund and the mighty Yellow Wall. Raphael, you were there on Saturday. How does it rank as a stadium to go to? Is it one of the greatest fixture experiences ever, going to that game against Bayern Munich?
I'm not sure I would rate the fixture such really highly.
Right.
Because it's a fairly recent phenomenon that this game is very meaningful. But the stadium and the stadium experience, especially with Mario Götze, the former Dortmund player, turning up there to the dog's abuse, was quite impressive. And then, of course, you know, even though it's a little bit sentimental and schmaltzy, etc., when 20,000 fans keep singing when their team... are losing 3-0 and effectively concede a title, it is pretty moving. It was hard not to feel a bit of a wow.
That's the title gone, is it? That.
Well, 7 points at the moment against this Bayern team, who are yet to be beaten, look like they'll go throughout the season unbeaten, possibly, certainly until the winter break. It's hard to see them lose a game. Very difficult to see Dortmund, with all their problems, make up that kind of ground. Having said that, recent history suggests that if they were to get knocked out in the Champions League and could perhaps concentrate on the Bundesliga, then they might be a force. Their first two titles came after they really pulled away, having been knocked out in the Europa League and the Champions League at the winter break.
That's interesting. Bayern, though, what a machine they are. 38 games now unbeaten. An extraordinary stat that was going around yesterday of the only team that stopped them scoring is their last 82 or 81 matches in all competitions. Do you know who that is?
Arsenal.
The Gunners. Remarkable. You mentioned Götze and his return to Westfalen Stadium, etc. And he warmed up inside the tunnel because he couldn't face his former fans.
Well, I'm not sure that was a decision on his part, because Thiago was also warming up in the tunnel. I think Guardiola just said, you know, it's not maybe the best idea to have them both warm up in front of 20,000 very irate Dortmund fans, because that's where they would have had to go.
Right.
Because they couldn't warm up behind the other side.
I'm just wondering, but they would have to come onto the pitch anyway, so does it not send a bit of a message to the players, like, you need to hide? Because,
well, if it did send that message, it didn't register, because they both certainly didn't hide. Götze scored the decisive goal, probably, and Thiago had an outstanding game when he came on, really changed the whole game. And it was super interesting. I know you're not really interested in tactics and all these things, James, but it was almost as if Bayern had two tactics for the game. The first half, they're playing a long game.
Right.
First time I've ever seen a Pep Guardiola side play so many long balls. The ball came back straight away. There was no possession, no control. In the second half, they brought the two small kids on, attacked from a lot deeper with control, and then effectively decided the game. So it was amazing to see, because the first half, you think, this is really not working. What are you doing? In the context of the 90 minutes, you realise there was that actually a pretty effective ploy.
Well, it was only amazing if you hadn't already read about it in Bild, which accurately forecasted that's exactly what Guardiola was going to do.
The first, the bit with the long balls was in Bild, yeah. And that, of course, then provoked Pep into a bit of a, not sure, fit of rage, but he was very upset because he said he'd noticed that Bild had a lot of right information over the last few weeks, right?
Which certainly stands out in that newspaper.
Yeah,
but and he's threatening to kick players out of the team.
He's threatening to kick out the mole.
All right. Then.
So now there's the very popular mole hunt going on.
Next up for Borussia, anyway, it is that crucial Champions League game against Napoli. How are they doing injury-wise, Borussia?
Well, not too bad, because Lukas Piszczek, the right-back, has come back. He had a bit of a cameo and looked very good. And he's been missing throughout the season, and he's been a very big miss.
Right. Subotic is out, Hummels is out.
Yeah, and Manuel Friedrich, the young 34-year-old that they've signed, can't play because he was signed after the deadline. So the most likely scenario is Sven Bender filling in at the back, which is not his preferred position. He's a holding midfielder. But apparently one that he can play very well.
All right, well, opponents Napoli coming into this off two straight defeats themselves. Before the international break, they were beaten by Juventus very convincingly. And then they lost at home to Parma, surprisingly, this weekend with a goal for Antonio Cassano. Hamzic getting injured, Rafa.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but
not at all.
Klopp...
is it some tactics?
Yeah.
Good.
Klopp was saying, you know, maybe Napoli will play the same way. Maybe they'll start playing
long balls
if they've seen this game. Because the point he was making was, it's actually not a bad idea. Yes, you don't necessarily play to your own strength, and Bayern certainly didn't when they played all these long balls, but they managed to get around the biggest strength of Dortmund, which is the pressing midfield.
Right.
You can't press balls that are 10 metres high up in the air.
Well, a draw is enough for Napoli. So, well, it's going to be an interesting game, that one.
It's tough. Tough for Dortmund.
Mm. Well, it's tough for Napoli as well. You know, away. Hamzic out there. I mean, they're probably their busiest player. But great news for them that Higuain, for this crucial away game, is actually fit. The other big Italian game, apart from Juventus' must-win fixture against Copenhagen, which, you know, Juve should be able to get the win that they need, is Milan's trip to Celtic. And oh my word, this is delicately balanced. In that group, Barcelona streets ahead on 10 points. Milan, having just lost to Barca, are on 5. Ajax have 4, Celtic have 3, and now host the Rossoneri at Celtic Park. Milan in all sorts of trouble. This weekend they drew at home to Genoa. Genoa were down to 10 men. Milan threw everything at them. They had 50 crosses, 39 shots, but still couldn't break the deadlock, and the fans were furious. They've only had one victory in their last 10. They were singing songs about "We are waiting for you" with sticks, and indeed about 400 ultras basically blocked the exits of the parking area underneath the San Siro and demanded to speak to the team, and eventually Kaká and the goalkeeper Abbiati went out to have a chat with them, and there were men there with sticks and stuff. I mean, there was no threat of violence per se, but it was made clear that the situation was not going to be tolerated for much longer. A lot of talk about players being out partying till late at night, that kind of thing.
I don't know. Is there any research into the effect of players being threatened by fans, either at the training ground or outside stadiums, and then subsequent results? It'd be quite interesting if there's any academics listening to this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd be interested to see the results.
I love the fact when players have been out on, you know, on the pop in a city or something, all the fans who have a go at them for it, if they saw them out, would be buying them drinks and dancing with them and whatnot.
I'm not sure if they'd be buying Kevin Constant drinks. He seems to be very much the target of their wrath. But anyway, there you go. That's the atmosphere that surrounds the club. Sunday morning then saw Mario Balotelli at 5 a.m. tweeting, "This is the end," enigmatically, although he's since said that he wasn't referring to his Milan career or anything like that. But he was among, I think, 5 Milan players that then turned up late for training. And there's a general air that things are, you know, turning when the winding gyre, the centre cannot hold the falcon, cannot hear the falconer, in a very real sense. So happy days, perhaps, for Celtic. Huge, huge match. Moving along in Champions League terms, all sorts of other big encounters. I'm quite excited by the Group C game between PSG and Olympiakos, because PSGs are on 10 points. Olympiakos in second place have 7. They also have that fella Konstantinos Mitroglou. Woof. Right. Anyway, and big action, of course, for the Spanish. So probably time for us to dial up the Sid Lowe.
Hello, Jimbo. How you doing?
Hi, Sid. I'm very well. You're not on a train today, are you?
Well, I was going to be, but my train's been cancelled, so I'm actually about to get on one, whereas you should have caught me about an hour into the journey.
I want to know where you're going, Sid.
I am going back to Madrid from Seville, because I was at the Seville Derby last night.
Right. Unpleasant scenes at the Seville Derby last night.
Yeah, there was. I mean, it's always a difficult one, isn't it? Because you kind of, you go to a stadium, a big game like that, where the atmosphere is fantastic, the fans are largely brilliant, but then it's very, very difficult to judge how many, but some I think Betis fans were monkey chanting Umbia, and then soon afterwards they monkey chanted Paulão. Now the most striking thing about that, I mean, you know, there's no two ways about this, it doesn't make it any worse because it's their own player, but the most striking thing about it was their own player that they monkey chanted after he was sent off, which was a decision that kind of went quite a long way to you know, kind of putting the game in a position where Sevilla were going to win it by a long way. Paulão was monkey chanted by some of the fans. Again, very difficult to judge how many. In the stadium, I must confess, that bout of monkey chanting, the second one to Paulão, I didn't hear in the stadium, but I've seen TV footage and a lot of people were contacting me on Twitter and showing me the images of that zooms in very close on Betis fans and shows it, because it's not just that they're clearly doing monkey chants, but some of them are doing monkey gestures. This morning in the papers, I've only seen one reference to it. No one talked about it last night, so I don't know how much of an issue this will become, although of course hopefully it's something that, because the images are so clear and it's going to be, I think, relatively simple to find those particular people and punish them, at least as individuals, if not the club, then hopefully something will happen this time.
But
I wouldn't hold your breath, sadly. Yeah. I mean, because the reality is that not enough is done.
Yeah. Well, a massive win anyway for Sevilla. 4-0 against Betis.
Yeah, the fans were a little disappointed, though. The last couple of minutes was really comic, because they got the fourth in, I think, the 88th or the 89th. And then the fans were going absolutely mad trying to get a fifth. I mean, in Spain, five goals is really symbolic. It's known as the manita, that the little hand. In other words, a goal for every finger. And they were really, really keen to get this fifth goal, not least because they'd beaten Betis 5-1 last year. So they were screaming at the team to pour forward in the last couple of minutes, even though they're 4-0 up. At one point, they got a corner. They were screaming at their goalkeeper to go up for the corner as well, because they really wanted the fifth goal. And then so the final whistle goes, and there's a little hint of disappointment, but it's kind of a pantomime disappointment. And of course they're really delighted with the 4-0 victory, one that leaves Betis bottom, and it's the first time that Sevilla have won two games in a row for 9 months.
Right. Well, I imagine then, by the same token, Barcelona fans will have been pretty disappointed to only win 4-0 against Granada.
Well, curiously enough, there is a slight sense of disappointment in that, because, as you know, because we've talked about it a lot, there's been this constant ongoing debate about Barcelona's style, about how they're playing, that the results are not enough, because the results have been absolutely spectacular this year. You know, they've only dropped points once all season, and they're beating teams very, very comfortably. But 4-0 at home against Granada, the first two goals from penalties, to be honest, you're right, it's not something that people are especially excited about.
Yeah. All right, so they won 4-0. Real Madrid got how many? Five?
Real Madrid got five. This is the great thing about it on Saturday night. So it's the old kind of Madrid-Barcelona, anything you can do, I can do better thing. But it's Barcelona-Madrid and Atletico Madrid. So anything you can do, I can do better. And I can do it better than both of you. 4 o'clock kickoff, Barcelona win 4-0. 8 o'clock kickoff, Real Madrid win 5-0. 10 o'clock kickoff, Atletico Madrid win 7-0. And James, if you'll permit me a woof, the goal from Diego Costa is ridiculously good. An overhead kick for Atletico. He only came on as a sub. And Atleti were absolutely brilliant. So the top three won this weekend, an aggregate score of, hang on, do the math.
16-0. 16-0. Yeah. Tell us about Diego Costa's goal, Sid.
Well, it's a ridiculous overhead kick, and it's an overhead kick where it's not even that natural for him to go for it. I mean, normally, you know, an overhead kick, you can kind of see how it's coming. The Rooney one, for example, you can see the way the ball's falling, it makes sense. This somehow was a little bit more awkward, but the connection on the ball is brilliant, and I think he's the outstanding player in Spain this season. Now, obviously, Cristiano Ronaldo is the best player in Spain at the moment, but he's the outstanding player in terms of how well he's played this season, in terms of the level of expectation. He's only 3 goals behind Cristiano Ronaldo in the top scorers chart, and Cristiano Ronaldo has scored 3 more penalties than him, so I suppose you could make an argument that says they're really not that far off each other.
Right.
The other thing is worth pointing out, I don't know if you were going to ask me about this, but let me tell you anyway.
Ronaldo's injury.
No, Carlos Vela became the first Mexican this weekend to score four goals in a La Liga game, and he instantly became my hero, Jimbo.
Because
if ever there was a player that you can use the word woof for, it's Carlos Vela, because he scores a hat-trick, gets the match ball, which all his teammates are signed, and he gets asked, what are you going to do with it? He says, I'm going to give it to my dog to play with.
That's astonishing. An astonishing decision by Carlos Vela.
Automatically became my hero when he said that.
All right, well, you're a big dog lover.
And Vela's hero too, yeah.
Now, about Ronaldo, who went off injured after Real Madrid were 1-0 up at the weekend. I read that Madrid are praying that he's fit for Wednesday, otherwise they'll have to work out what to do with 45,000 CR7 masks.
No, he won't be fit for Wednesday.
Right.
And as you say, that is a problem because of this slightly bizarre being John Malkovich but being Cristiano Ronaldo thing that they were planning to support Cristiano Ronaldo, as you say. 45, I really wish they'd do it. I mean, it'd be sensational, wouldn't it? 45,000 people in Cristiano Ronaldo masks. But he's not going to make it to the game on Wednesday. Aww. Don't yet know if he'll play against Valladolid at weekend. There might be a temptation from a just point of view to let him rest because the following weekend is a Copa del Rey game and he's suspended. So I suppose there might be a temptation to say, well, look, why don't we take him out of these two games, which probably don't matter, because I think they'll win in the league against Valladolid at home anyway. The Champions League game doesn't matter, and give him 2 weeks. The problem with that theory is I can't see Cristiano Ronaldo wanting to take a break for 2 weeks. Can you, right, particularly now at the heart of this Ballon d'Or battle?
Yeah, what's his injury, Sid?
It's what they describe in Spain as a bocadillo, a sandwich, which basically means a knock and a thigh, a dead leg, basically.
Why do they call it a bocadillo?
I don't know. I don't know. A bocadillo sounds like the kind of challenge Luis Suarez makes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Nice one. Yeah, very nice. Here we go. Would AC Jimbo care to ask Sid about the rumour that Xavi Alonso would leave Real Madrid already in January, and even for free? Is he desperate to go, Sid?
Well, already in January is a logistical reality because his contract's up at the end of the season, so in January he can start to talk to other clubs legally. Obviously, players do illegally anyway, but he can. And it's been very, very slow, the process in this, and I think there's been some significant doubts, but right now, if I was a betting man, I'd be telling you that Xabi Alonso will renew his deal with Real Madrid.
Oh.
But he has an awful lot of clubs after him, and of course it makes sense to hear what they're saying. Madrid has started being a bit bullish about this. Madrid have started briefing off the record that, yeah, don't worry, it'll definitely happen. And that's partly because of, a kind of coming together of them and a belief that Alonso now does want to stay, whereas perhaps a year ago they wouldn't have been quite so sure. So it needs to be closed off, but I think it will be closed off. So I think he's going to stay.
Okay. Beep, beep. Think your train's going to leave soon, Sid.
Yeah, there are people hanging out windows waving white hankies, Jimbo.
All right, well, we're walking kind of metaphorically along the platform as you pull out of the station.
Are you blowing kisses at me?
I am. I'm waving a little hanky. Cheerio, Sid. Cheerio.
Goodbye.
Bye then.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
That's it for part two. Coming up, Chelsea and other things too.
To buy your copy of Tales from the Secret Footballer for just £6.50, that's 50% off the recommended retail price, head to The Guardian Bookshop at guardianbookshop.co.uk/footballtales and enter the offer code TALES. That's TALES. The offer's valid until the 24th of December.
Part 3, Chelsea. They're on top of their Champions League group. They are 3 points ahead of Schalke, but they are going to be away at Basel, who are on 5 points. One behind Schalke, four behind Chelsea. And Basel, of course, graveyard of so many European hopes of English teams in the past.
True, but Chelsea beat them, of course, last year on the way to the Europa League triumph.
But they lost against them this season, Rafa.
They did. They lost at home.
Right.
I suspect, though, that they're in a much better position now than they were in the beginning of the season, Chelsea, with finding slowly but surely a formation that works in blending.
Is this the same Chelsea team that lost at Newcastle, almost lost at home to West Brom, and only won because they were playing West Brom without a striker this
and
weekend?
And won 3-0 against West Ham.
Oh, sorry, West Ham. Yeah.
Yeah. That is the same Chelsea. But, I mean, they're really, I think, in that West Ham game was a realisation that maybe Mourinho has finally stumbled upon a change of formation that works, both in the sense what he wants, which is control, power in midfield, back four being very solid, and just getting a bit of what is undoubtedly a wealth of talent in terms of the attacking midfielders that he has. So now he's come up with a Christmas tree formation, which is right.
West Ham
right
getting some guests as well.
Yeah, he certainly did.
And I suspect that away to Basel is the perfect kind of game for this Chelsea team. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they do to Basel what they did to Schalke, which was basically sit and then hit them really, really hard on the break. And I was speaking to a colleague of mine from Switzerland this morning, and they all suspect a similar outcome, simply because Basel, after that great win at Stamford Bridge, managed then to lose against Schalke quite poorly, and of course only drew twice with Steaua Bucharest, which really was very poor.
Right, okay. Well, they certainly need the victory at Basel, and we mentioned the West Ham game. They're in some trouble now, the Hammers. Of all the teams to be without a big striker, Big Sam's probably the least best placed.
Yeah, I think this Kevin Nolan experiment isn't really working, and I think also when you're putting a lot of your hopes on Ravel Morrison, as talented as he is, he's also very erratic. I mean, Big Sam, you almost make a Faustian pact with him, really. You perhaps aren't going to get the best football ever, but he will normally keep your team up. He's a bit like Tony Pulis in that respect. But I think the way they are playing this season does give you cause for concern, and they are, I mean, I don't think they're one of the worst three teams at the moment, but they are, you know, they're certainly playing very poorly at the moment.
There are only goal difference outside the bottom three, and there's a long way to go till January.
Yeah.
So,
I think with Allardyce, generally he's been quite frugal the way he spends money in the past. He's spent a lot of money on Andy Carroll there, and there was always a risk that he'd be injured because he's proved that he gets injured a lot, and it's happened now, and they've not really had a plan B for that happening, and they've really suffered. They're just like treading water, basically, as a football team.
I mean, once they conceded that first goal, you sort of thought that was it, really. But that was not very good at all.
All right, well, you mentioned Tony Pulis, and he is the new face of Crystal Palace, excitingly enough. Great news for Cameron Jerome. Jerome is there on loan, I believe, till the end of the season, isn't that right? From Stoke. He was under Tony Pulis at Stoke, and when Tony Pulis left, was quite free and forthright in his views on Tony Pulis to the local media before being sent on loan to Crystal Palace. So he must have had a real surprise when he
played very well for Crystal Palace in front of Tony Pulis at the weekend.
Yeah. But we'll have to see whether Tony's going to include him in his plans, because that was the problem. He didn't get much of a look in under him before, and Jerome was saying basically Pulis goes with his 11, doesn't matter what you do in training. He never lets other people into the team. Is that the right appointment, do you think, for Crystal Palace? After a month of dithering and dithering?
I'm surprised they went with Pulis. I thought they would have chosen perhaps someone younger, perhaps someone who's also, I think, style of football had sort of been found out. He spent quite, I mean, fair play to him, he got Stoke up. I was at his first game as a Stoke manager against Walsall back in, I think, 2002 or 2003. And the crowd was singing at him after 70 minutes, "You don't know what you're doing." And then, you know, after that, he did incredibly well. You know, fair play to him. But there was a sense last season, teams had found him out. He'd spent a lot of money for not really much success. And I don't know, if I was a director of football or a chairman, Pulis wouldn't be my first option.
No. I don't think he was a first option. I think they panicked after talking to a lot of managers who turned them down. And I don't know, I think he kind of screams, "We'll be okay," in a way. And I can see why, if you're in such a precarious situation, you want to lean on somebody who's got the experience of, I wouldn't say lost causes, but, you know, keeping a very limited side up.
Well, I think he was the first option. Then he wanted too much money. Then they went, looked around, and then they decided to go with him in the end. If I was in charge, I would give Pulis perhaps to the end of the year with a massive fat bonus if they keep up. And then
because that worked with Harry Redknapp famously, didn't it?
Indeed it did. Mm.
There are only 3 points from safety, Crystal Palace. Fulham are right down there as well, and they had a loss against Swansea.
It's all Rennie Mullenstein's fault.
With the animals?
No, I mean, they're in a strange position, because if they'd won this game, you know, the headlines would all have been, "Oh, he's made such a big difference."
Right.
And now the headlines are, "Yol is still under huge pressure."
It's a nice way of sacking someone, bringing in a joint manager.
But then when I spoke to Shahid Khan a few weeks ago, he did say, "Look, we are looking for an experienced coach. Martin Yol is completely on board with this." Insisted he wasn't going to be making any hasty decisions. At the same time, Fulham have only won one of their last 10 Premier League home matches, and that always was Fulham's strength. I mean, this season, like, they've conceded the opening goal in 9 out of their 12 games, and they've gone on to lose 8 of those, and that's the most in the division. I mean, they're starting poorly, they're losing lots of games, and it is not looking good.
Alright, Sunderland saw their recent run disrupted, or rather they had to play a game away from home at Stoke and lost, and the West Brown red card, an extraordinary decision.
It was an extraordinary decision when, you know, you look at it and he won the ball and just clipped Adam. The one thing I would say is that kind of tackle now, though, anything with excessive force where you come in from the front, referees are being so harsh. They've been told they've got to clamp down on that kind of tackle. And if it's so fast and they misjudge what they think they've seen, then they're just giving red cards out for those tackles. Now, even if you win the ball, and I know he did win the ball and that wasn't, and he shouldn't have been sent off for that because it was barely a foul. But I just think now players probably have to make a judgment of whether it's even worth going in for a 50-50, you know, in with any kind of force, because you could end up getting sent off by just misjudging it slightly, or, you know, getting your timing slightly wrong.
Right. The ref didn't seem clear on what his decision was going to be. He waited several seconds, but I was just surprised that he didn't maybe talk to the linesman who was right there.
He should have. I would have thought, I don't know what the linesman, whether it happened so quickly that the linesman just was looking at something else. Maybe he's, you know, he's considering what he's going to do when he got home or something.
Right, yeah, very possibly. And we shouldn't go without mentioning Newcastle, who climbed down to eighth with their third straight win. Here's Optigeon with a great stat. Only Lyon this season have had more goals by French players than Newcastle in the major European leagues.
They've scored 16 out of the 17 goals of French players, which is extraordinary.
Incredible, no? And like Rennie again, Gouffran, and De Choulamiobi getting lots of plaudits.
And dropped Hassan Ben Arfa as well. And I, you know, presume he's decided that he's maybe a disruptive influence in the team.
Really? Interesting.
So the talking point said today.
All right, good. There you go. Well, that is the Premier League weekend number 12, and some big Champions League action on the way. We'll be back on Thursday to review all of that. But in the meantime, thanks very much to guest producer Pete, who's with us this week, because Ben, voice of the Secret Footballer advert, is off in New York. And thanks also to Sean Ingle and to Raphael Honigstein and Greg Bukowski. And you, listener, will be back on Thursday. Have a super week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.